Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you, Father Petrie, for your wonderful talks already. I feel a little bit awkward as the philosopher speaking on theology of the body. That's already awkward enough, but speaking after the theologian. But it's helped me to focus on the sense in which I think that philosophy really does support theology of the body. And I'll just mention this little autobiographical detail because I think I'm a little bit weird in this respect, in other respects too, but in this respect, I'm a little bit weird. So I'm a convert to Catholicism and I'm a convert to Christianity. I became a Christian in college, and then about 10 years later, I was received in the Catholic Church. But I believed Catholic teaching on contraception before I was a Catholic for philosophical reasons. It just seemed right to me. That's rare. But it is a natural law position. And I think that's an important thing for us to keep in mind, even as we're trying to appreciate an explicitly Christian attempt to share those truths. So I'm going to talk a little bit about philosophy today. I think Father did a really excellent job of describing, laying out the context and the content of theology of the body, and even helping us to understand what kind of a teaching it is. But let's acknowledge that it's a pretty strange kind of a teaching. And it's been characterized in all sorts of different ways, right? It's a biblical exegesis. I think this is something that the Father Petrie emphasized, particularly of Genesis, but of other parts of Scripture as well. To the extent that people talk about it philosophically, they might bring in the personalism or phenomenology of John Paul II and say that it's kind of a phenomenology of marriage, or even more specifically, a phenomenology of the sexual urge. Like, what does that mean, that we were created with this? Obviously, it's relevant to sexual ethics, and so people turn to it if they have certain kinds of ethical questions that they hope to have answered. It's a theological anthropology. It's a story about what human beings are, where we came from, what our nature is, what our destiny is. I would also venture to say, I think it's less commonly described this way, but I would venture to say that it is a part of Catholic social teaching, an articulation of Catholic social teaching, specifically on the family. I think Humanae Vitae is Catholic social teaching, especially in this sense. A lot of modern Catholic social teaching is spelling out things that people would have once upon a time taken for granted, but the circumstances of modern society have changed so much that they need to be articulated in fresh ways. And the circumstances of modern society present grave new risks that we need to protect ourselves against. So if you think about Catholic social teaching in general as a kind of cultural risk management, and then you think about the family as something that is at risk of being sort of forgotten or undergoing all kinds of new threats, I think Humanae Vitae is cultural risk management for the family. It's sometimes talked about as including all kinds of prophecies that came true. But the flip side of that is that it's not just prophecy. It's just like looking around and realizing, hey, this is what we have to worry about down the line. And theology of the body, as we saw from Father Petrie's talks, is an attempt to articulate the teaching of Humanae Vitae that was in a frustrating and almost funny way, left almost completely unarticulated, right? Father Petrie quoted this line, but right when it gets to the hard teaching, it's like, which people will, you know, of goodwill will see just follows from natural reason. We're like, what? Okay, show us the way. So those are a bunch of different ways that I think we could characterize theology of the body. And some of those are emphasizing, I think, the rhetorical challenge that John Paul II was facing. So that another way that theology of the body has come off as a kind of reenchantment of natural law teaching about the family. re-enchantment or even re-romanticizing. Father Petrie also mentioned this, that some versions of theology of the body seem to over-romanticize, seem to lead people to unrealistic expectations about the sort of glorious spiritual heights that the married couple will achieve in their activity together. I think John Paul II was willing to take that risk. He was compensating for a loss of romantic, a loss of enchantment. And so, yeah, it's not a surprise that some people might have taken it to the other extreme. I'm going to talk about something specifically philosophical, and I'm going to relate theology of the body to some central teachings of Aristotle. John Paul II was a kind of Thomist. Thomas Aquinas thought of Aristotle as the philosopher. And to the extent that the content of the theology of the body is meant to articulate some philosophical principles, some natural principles, even if the rhetorical context required John Paul II to draw on specifically Christian biblical language, I think it's helpful to think about the extent to which Aristotle and specifically Aristotle's understanding of our social nature is embodied or communicated in the theology of the body. The key concept that it seems to me that we get from Aristotle that has been lost or harder for us to keep alive is the idea that some communities are natural. There's such a thing as a natural community. Why is that a hard idea to maintain? Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is more explicitly theoretical. I think the dominant strain of modern political philosophy is working against the idea that community is a natural thing. And then I also think there are cultural circumstances, especially technological circumstances, that make it hard for us to think of communities as natural. So the first, from the perspective of political philosophy, some of you have heard of social contract theory. Some of you have taken maybe a survey of political philosophy that started with Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau. Thinkers who disagreed about a lot of things, but they all agreed that we needed some account of how human beings act together in political concert. And they all assumed that what's natural is human beings and what's artificial is politics. That's the whole idea of social contract, that human beings don't find themselves in community. They have to make community. Community is something fabricated. Community is something that we have control of. We can create it. We can argue over which kind of political community to create or the circumstances under which it can be created. But the common strain among the dominant trend of modern political philosophy is that community is artificial. And we can kind of understand that because we do feel that, we have some power or control over communities. But it enforces the dominant strain of what's sometimes called liberal theory in the classical sense, right? That at root, we are just individuals. It's individuals and their choices. And then if there's something else on top of that, like a political community or like a marriage, right? That is something that is made by the will of individuals, and that the only source of right and wrong in measuring better and worse ways to build, fabricate the artifice that is community is in terms of the will of the individual, in terms of consent, right? So rhetorically, you often see this today, that people can't possibly fathom any argument about right and wrong behavior, especially between two consenting adults, right? Except in terms of whether consent is present or not. It's notoriously slippery, and anybody who thinks too long about it realizes that you can't possibly build a moral worldview simply on the basis of consent. But it's still very, very common to try, and that's part of the individualistic or liberal or social contract mentality, again, that treats community as something made rather than given, or fabricated rather than existing by nature. So the second factor that I think clouds the idea of communities as natural from us is the fact that our lives are so much shaped by technology. Now, technology is it's a flexible word, and you know, you can count all kinds of things as technology. Human beings have never lived without technology. Language is a technology. But the particular kinds of technology that have developed over the last, let's say, 200 years, 200 to 300 years, the Industrial Revolution, the Digital Revolution, they have surrounded us with powerful tools that have transformed the scale of human community, the scale at which we experience what it's like to be connected to people. So many of the original problems of Catholic social teaching were simply responding to the ways in which new problems were arising because trains were connecting cities, for instance. You know, you used to live a life, everyone took it for granted that life was sort of inherently limited in a certain way, that communities had a certain scale, and that, you know, time and space forced us into certain constraints within which we could do our creative work. But modern technology breaks down some of those constraints, and we experience life and politics and communication on totally different scales. There's an irony, though, in the age of technology, which is that when we talk about technology, we think about it as a tool, as something that gives us more power, as something that strengthens our ability to do the things that we were already wanting to do. That's what a tool does, right? It just makes things easier or more efficient, or gives you leverage to reach farther than you could otherwise reach. That's how we talk about tools. That's how we talk about technology. In fact, though, the most powerful technologies have a very different effect on us. They don't enable us to do more or better or faster or more cheaply the things that we are already doing. They enable us to do different things that we hadn't been doing before, and they often enable us to stop doing things that we used to take for granted as necessary. So Russell Hittinger has a great essay about technology and liberalism, in which he makes this crucial distinction, which I think is really, really valuable. Some kinds of tools are genuinely labor-saving devices. They enable you to get done the thing that you were already trying to do, but spare you some of the labor that it would take to do it. That's how we typically think of a tool, as a labor-saving device. But some technologies, precisely because they're so powerful and they get adopted widely, and they therefore transform the habits of and patterns of interaction among people, they turn out not to be labor-saving. They turn out to be act-replacing devices. It turns out that having this technology doesn't make it easier for you to do something you were already doing. It makes you forget that there was something that you should be doing, or it makes you do something else altogether. One of Hittinger's examples of this is the nuclear weapon. It's such a powerful bomb, right, that instead of being integrated into traditional diplomacy, where states who didn't fully agree would have to work things out, and then if they couldn't work things out, maybe they would have a certain kind of violent confrontation about it. Because this new weapon isn't just something, a tool that could be used in war to fight out a conflict, right? But it would destroy everybody. You don't have diplomacy anymore. He wrote this, I don't know, it's probably almost 30 years ago now, but still very relevant. So I don't know if you've even heard of this phrase, but the policy of mutually assured destruction between the Soviet Union and the United States, right? He said the policy of mutually assured destruction replaces diplomacy. There's no diplomacy. People from the United States don't have to go talk to people from the Soviet Union to work things out. We just hold this mutual threat against each other, You do something we don't like, we'll destroy you. And we know you'll destroy us. So hopefully we won't fight. That's not diplomacy. It's something else. Right? Now, in this essay, Hittinger speaks for length about how contraception is an example of something that people think is a labor-saving device. There's a pun to be made there, too, if you want, but that's beside the point. They think of it as a labor-saving device, but it's actually an act-replacing device. That the work of spouses in marriage, if before the modern contraceptive technology came along, especially the pill, if they had good reasons or even bad reasons for wanting to regulate fertility, they would have to talk to each other. They would have to do things like be patient and listen and practice periodic abstinence and all kinds of things that would strengthen a marriage. The technology doesn't make that easier. In fact, it makes it harder, replaces all of those things. Because you can get the outcome and circumvent all of the social virtues that would lead to that outcome, right? Just pop the pill. No need to communicate, no need to be patient, no need to practice virtue. So I mentioned technology as the second, so if bad political theory is kind of top down, the technological culture in which we live, even for people who haven't, taken a political philosophy class or imbibed this way of talking about rights and consent, we all live in an age in which certain powers that we have as human beings are disguised from us by the technology that we have integrated into our habits and ways of life. And I think both of those forces make it hard for us to appreciate the sense in which there are certain kinds of communities that really are natural. So I'm going to talk about three dimensions of Aristotle that I think bring this out, that help us to revive the idea of certain kinds of communities as natural. For Aristotle, the human being is the rational animal. Right? That sounds kind of trite. It rolls off the tongue very easily. You've all heard it before, but already there's something very paradoxical about that. We are an animal. We are an embodied biological thing. We're an organism. And yet we have this thing that Aristotle and every other Greek philosopher associated with something that somehow transcended the physical world. It's a spark of the divine. Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, everybody talked about reason that way. So we are an animal with this other thing that other animals don't have. We're set apart. Aristotle also thought of us as the social animal. So other animals might coordinate their activity. Bees make hives, right? Wolves hunt in packs. But they do that out of instinct. It just happens. Human beings are social in a distinctive way because they're rational. So when Aristotle says we're the social animal, that is a dimension of our rationality. We are, as animals, we can't live alone. We need the help of other members of our species, even actually more than most other species, right? A baby horse gets born, it's running the day it's born, right? And it's basically full size. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a yearling and a 10-year-old horse, most of you, by the time it's a year old. Think about how slow human beings are to develop, how radically dependent babies are on their parents to be raised, to become full members of the species. So for Aristotle, it was part of our nature that we depend on each other, and that because we depend on each other, we figure out ways to live together to bring out our natures through society. And society isn't a herd. Society isn't a hive. Society is the human rational animal living in community. That still might sound, though, like community is something artificial, as if well, there's stuff that happens biologically, and then there's stuff that human beings choose by reason. But here's the first sign that Aristotle wouldn't quite put it that way, that he doesn't think of community as artificial. In the Nicomachean Ethics, for instance, he's willing to talk about something called natural justice. Natural justice, or justice according to nature. Justice, for Aristotle was a word associated with law, and so was most evident within a particular community where they've decided you're not allowed to bring food into this seminar room, right? Or you have to drive on this side of the road in this country or this side of the road in this other country, where there might not be an absolute right or wrong, but it makes sense that this community would judge that we're going to construct this law. So to do justice to the Thomistic Institute, you can have water in here, but you shouldn't bring food in here except during the dispensation or jubilee of the morning. There are some things that seem to transcend a particular community's decision, some things that seem to be right or wrong, regardless of whether the community has already decided it. And this actually was a little bit awkward for Aristotle to express. We trace the natural law tradition to Aristotle, but he never really used that phrase natural law. He kind of approached it once, but that in Greek, it would have sounded odd to talk about natural law, because law meant something contrived by human beings, the nomos, and phusis meant something that existed prior to human will, phusis, physics. But he was willing to talk about natural justice. So there are things that are right or wrong by nature, not because human beings have decided them to be so. Murder's wrong. Theft is wrong. Adultery is wrong. Aristotle takes this for granted. You don't find any arguments for this in Aristotle. He thinks everybody knows this, at least everybody worthy of listening to a lecture about ethics or political science. So there's such a thing as natural justice. If there's such a thing as natural justice, then there's at least some form of ways that human beings relate to each other that pre-exists human decision-making, that human decision-making is supposed to conform to, right? And that even the formation of a particular government would have to conform to. But if you read most social contract theorists, Hobbes is the most honest about this. Hobbes just says, before the social contract, there's no justice. It's a war of all against all. It's just your will. You might say that, you know, you don't want your rights violated, but you're just trying to use rhetoric to stop me from exerting my will. There's no way to adjudicate that until we create the state, according to Hobbes. Aristotle would totally reject that. There is right and wrong even before human beings contrive a particular mode of governance. Here's another dimension in which it's evident that Aristotle wouldn't think of everything that human beings have a role in creating as if it were therefore purely artificial or subject to will without any standards. For Aristotle, our reason is not only instrumental. We don't just use our minds to find a means towards some given end. Instrumental reason takes for granted that there's a goal, and us being the clever animal means that we're better at figuring out means towards that goal, right? So if you want power, you'll figure out how to do this. If you want food, you'll figure out how to do that. It's true that we can use our reason to calculate means towards an end, but Aristotle spends a lot of time talking about how the real power of reason, what makes us rational animals, isn't that we're clever and good at solving things or planning or puzzling things out. It's that we can know the truth and we can ask, is this an end I should pursue? So reason has an instrumental function, but its instrumental function can't be cut off from its, let's call it its sapiential function. It's supposed to actually reflect on and judge the ends that it seeks, right? So maybe you want power, but like, should you want power, or what kind of power should you want? That's not an instrumental question. That's not a how do you get from point A to point B. That is raising which point B should you choose to seek, and that is a power of reason too. That's not just something that we can take for granted. We have to use our reason to reflect on the ends that we seek. The third Aristotelian insight that I'll mention that I think helps us understand the significance of the idea that some communities are natural is that for Aristotle, politics is a form of friendship. Politics is a form of friendship. What do I mean by that? Well, it's probably easiest to illustrate with a contrast. The reason that might sound even a little bit weird to us, right, is that we think that we need politics to solve problems where friendship would fail, right? If we're friends and we can just all get along, share our resources, then we don't need to invoke, you know, a lawmaker to tell us what to do or a judicial apparatus to solve our differences. We can just let things slide. We can trust each other, right? And that politics comes in where friendship fails, right? Once you live with people that you can't trust, with people that you don't find yourself friends with, then you need to invent politics to sweep in and solve your problems, tell people how to act, write the laws, enforce the laws, adjudicate disagreements about the laws. I think that's how most of us would think of the relationship between friendship and politics. Right? But for Aristotle, politics is about people coordinating their action for the common good. You don't have politics, according to Aristotle, unless you already have people who share a life together and are seeking something together. Now, that sounds very foreign to us because, again, our imagination when we think of politics first goes to such a large scale that we don't feel ourselves as having a common good or end together, except maybe something very minimal like safety, like let's figure out how we can avoid killing each other. But we don't share anything robust as like we're all engaged in a common project. But political, remember, comes from a Greek word for the most natural political community, which was a city. And not even, don't think of New York City or Los Angeles, right? A town. A Greek polis is basically like a college campus. A couple thousand people, some differentiated roles to manage resources, but with a cooperative purpose, right? At least I hope you feel a cooperative purpose on a college campus. Even modern universities are so big that they sometimes don't feel like communities, right? So for Aristotle, you can't have a political community unless you already have people working together towards a common end. And working together towards a common end with another person is having a friend. That's just what it is to have a friend. Friends are people who share a common end and they collaborate or coordinate their efforts, their activity together towards that end. If that's the case, right, then I'm sure Aristotle would look around today and say, yeah, you have a lot of things that you call political communities that are quite artificial and don't need to exist, and there's nothing natural about them. But that doesn't mean that all political communities are artificial. There are very basic societies, very basic natural communities that we can't live without. Some form of political community or other is necessary. Something like the Greek polis, and certainly the family. The family is the first natural community. And it's natural in the sense that it fulfills our nature and we couldn't be who we are without it. We heard a little bit this morning, Aristotle can't be trusted around the edges of, you know, the specifics of biology and the sexist assumptions of his day. But he took for granted that husband and wife were friends. He raised a question about whether they could be perfect friends, because in his mind, perfect friendship involves 100% absolute equality of status. And so to the extent that now we would say husband and wife are complementary, they're not equal, they're complementary. But to the extent that they're not absolutely equal, he thought they don't have a certain kind of fullness of friendship. But actually, I think he would admit that because they don't have that kind of fullness of friendship, they can have another kind of friendship. Namely, they can seek the education of their children together. So he never doubted the naturalness of the family, the need for husbands and wives to work together on a common good that was essential to their flourishing and the flourishing of their children. I've reviewed three ways in which I think Aristotle has insights about human nature that challenge the idea that communities are natural. Right. The first way is the idea that there's such a thing as justice before any human choice, that when we discern right and wrong, we're actually trying to conform to a natural sense of justice, not just deciding that I will abide by the laws of my local community. The second is that reason is not only instrumental, but that it actually discerns the truth about these things, about the ends that we should seek. And the third is that the seeking of ends together that constitutes friendship is what Aristotle thinks politics is about. So to the extent that we find ourselves already sort of thrown into the world with certain roles to play with respect to each other, as sons and daughters, as brothers and sisters, as parts of families, we already always find ourselves as having some common purpose with others. And the idea of the common good, we might say, is the sort of unifying theme of all of these three Aristotelian insights. The idea that there is a shared goal that the community has that is shared in the sense not that it's pieced up and divided in equal portions among everybody, but in the sense that every member must actively participate in the seeking of it, and every member becomes more truly what they're supposed to be in the coordinated achievement of that activity. Cicero has a definition of friendship that differs a little bit from Aristotle's main definition, but it actually, I think, summarizes better than Aristotle did what friendship is about. He says it's goodwill and concord in all things human and divine. Goodwill and concord in all things human and divine. So about how we live and about the ultimate end of everything, the most important things, divine. Goodwill and concord. Now, concord it's an okay translation in English. But it could imply simply like agreement. He thinks that and I do too. Or it could imply a kind of harmony of emotions, like, oh, you resonate this way, so do I. We're vibing together. It actually implies something more than just common mind and common will. It implies common intentional action. So the Greek word, there's a word in Aristotle that Cicero is thinking of, is homonoia. And it would literally be translated as same-mindedness, right? Where the mind is what most, is your essence. It's what determines who you are. And to have homonoia with someone else, to have concord with them, isn't just to sort of agree to the same truths or to share the same will, but it is to be engaged in the same activity with them. It is to be seeking something together so that you are harmonizing together, right? Musicians in an orchestra seek homonoia, right? It's not just that they know the same things or that they happen to be doing the same things, right? But that they essentially come to be thinking as one, right? In and through the leadership of a good conductor. All of that suggests that that is what is natural for human beings, to find ourselves in situations where we recognize we aren't fully ourselves except through that concord, that homonoia, that participated action with others. And if that's the case, then at the end of the day, not every community can be purely artificial. It's not entirely up to us how we build our societies. We're going to have to discern with our minds, not just instrumental reason, how best it is that we can share and participate in the pursuit of goods together. And there will be better and worse ways to do that. The ones that don't actually achieve our flourishing and fulfillment are contrary to natural justice. And the ones that do, we will be more fully realized in the achievement of natural justice. That's my sort of sketch of Aristotelian political philosophy. And I realize I've done something kind of strange. Instead of like trying to unite all the different descriptions of theology of the body that I gave at the beginning, I added another even more left field description. I'm describing theology of the body as a kind of Aristotelian political philosophy. I am. And I think that that's consistent with what John Paul II says. It is a view about how human beings are born into natural communities and what it means to be a political animal, given that we're embodied rational creatures. Another sense in which we could say that there's an Aristotelian dimension to theology of the body is that I think it very clearly touches on all four of the cardinal virtues, right? It is a Christian teaching at the end of the day, at least rhetorically. And so maybe Father can add something about the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, which are definitely operative in theology of the body. But I just want to say something about the four cardinal virtues: wisdom, justice, courage, and temperance. The theology of the body, I think, obviously touches on all of these, right? Wisdom, the ability to discern and judge about the truth. We might say prudence instead of wisdom. In other words, it's not just instrumental reason, puzzling out how to get what we already want, but figuring out what we should want and grasping that and making good judgments about how to achieve that. Justice, that's been the theme of my talk, right? That the theology of the body is part of a discussion of how human beings find their proper role, their responsibility as members of a species that lives naturally in community. The most obvious virtue at stake, let's admit it, is temperance, right? If the theology of the body at the end of the day is meant to defend church teaching on contraception against practical and conceptual challenges, right? It's basically a reminder of the value of chastity. But that leaves the last cardinal virtue, courage. And this is related to my comment earlier about how I think rhetorically, at least, John Paul II is very much depending on the need to help people rediscover the proper sense of honor and shame. Human life has an intrinsic dignity. Dignity is a word that appeals to a certain part of our soul, right? It implies that there's something worthy in us, and that there are less and more noble pursuits for human beings to seek. And the challenge of natural law and specifically Catholic teaching about sexual ethics in the 20th and into the 21st century has been that that part of the soul has been neglected. Plato called it the spirited part of the soul. C.S. Lewis called it the chest in Men Without Chests, or the Abolition of Man. Right? It's probably the hardest part of the soul for us to even understand. Right? We get the head, we get the passions, but that middle part of the soul that feels a sense of pride and dignity, that should feel shame at dishonorable activity, but then sometimes doesn't. I think of what John Paul II is trying to do in the theology of the body is help to give people not just the sort of theoretical support that would justify chastity, but the sense of honor and dignity that is required to maintain and commit to that kind of life. Right? It takes effort, and it takes a certain sense of one's dignity, and that there are higher and noble ways to be a human being, and then less ignoble and frankly shameful ways. And we live in an age in which a lot of people are just not ashamed of things they should be. And we need to sometimes be reminded of what the standards are that we should hold ourselves to. So that's how I see all four of the cardinal virtues from Aristotle and Plato and the whole tradition reflected in the theology of the body: justice, prudence, or wisdom, temperance, obviously, but especially in the rhetorical style and in reminding people of our origin in God, our sense of dignity and worth, which fits with John Paul II's famous motto, right? Which is an exhortation to courage: be not afraid, be not afraid.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.